Blog Talk Radio.
Hi there, it's me, it's Fran Lewis. Yeah, and it is time for book discussion or focus discussion. And we are absolutely so thrilled today to have film producer, screenwriter Peter Lefcourt that is going to talk about his book, The American Family. We're going to talk about digital publishing and a whole lot more. So welcome, Peter. How are you?
Hi, Fran. I'm fine. It's the show, but the book is An American Family.
An American Family.
Not the American family, because there's a lot more than one American family. This is one of many.
We've got this. So, question: what made you decide to write this book and share it with readers?
Well, it's always a big question and a difficult question for any writer to answer, because I think most of our books come from someplace in our subconscious. Sometimes with a book you can identify a germ, and say, I was sitting on a bus one day and I saw something and it just gave me an idea to write something. This particular book I think is different because it is what I refer to. It's not an autobiographical novel, but it is what I call a cultural autobiography. Mm. I am a first generation American. My father was born in Poland, my mother was born in Russia, and they met in New York. And I am fascinated by the subject of how immigrant families develop, how they assimilate, how they reject and accept parts of the culture, and how each generation moves a little farther away from that immigrant mentality, but always retains a certain amount of it. Mm. So that kind of was the subject matter of this book, and though it is not about my family, the book is the story of five siblings born in the 1940s. I only had one sibling, though I was born in the 1940s, so it is my generation, but it is not my family. And though it is specifically about a Jewish American family, I believe it does capture the experience of all first-generation families, Italian, Irish, Vietnamese, Persian, African-American, and there's something about immigrant families that we can all relate to because we're a nation of immigrants.
That is so true. So what is your definition? That was my first question. I sort of changed it around. If you had to define an American family during the 60s, or you had to define the words American families from the time you started to write this till the end of it, what would you say the definition of an American family would be?
Well, that's, again, a difficult question. I think there's something universal about all families, first of all. I think that there is more in common between an American family and Nigerian family than we would think there would be, because there's something universal about families. The book spans a period of time that begins, I chose to begin and end this book on two iconic dates, so it's not exclusively about the 1960s. It begins, the first chapter of the book is the day that John Kennedy was assassinated. This is a date and time that almost everybody can remember specifically what they were doing. And I introduce each of my main characters, the five siblings and the parents, as they get the news of the Kennedy assassination. And I end the book 38 years later, approximately, on September 11th, 2001, another date that is iconic in our memories. And again, things happen on that date which affect the characters. So the book is not just about the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. It's about really four decades in the life of these characters and in the life of the family. Families, to me, are the strongest psychological institution in our society. We are all pulled into our family and simultaneously want to escape it. There's a kind of push-pull I think most of us have when we think of our families. We love our families, we're drawn to them, and yet we need to break away from the sort of clutch that they have, the emotional clutch. There's a great quote from Robert Frost, which I love. He says, "Home is where when you have to go there, they have to take you in." And it sort of says it all about families.
Yes, you did. Okay,
well, Robert Frost did.
I love Robert Frost, too. Now, question. Why did you choose to make Nathan? Okay, we're going to talk about the characters. We're not going to give away too much about them. Mm-hmm. But I do have, like I said, I have a favorite character in the book that reminds me of my grandfather. Uncle Meyer was my favorite character in the book, but Nathan, he's like the glue that holds it all together. They used to say that about my mom, that she was the glue that held everything together. So how did you create Uncle Meyer, and why did you make Nathan as the link to the entire family?
Well, Nathan is the father of the five siblings, and he is the pivotal person. He is the one that comes from the old country, establishes himself in America, and essentially procreates. Uncle Meyer is his uncle, who actually precedes him to America. But Nathan is really the character who is the one who actually assimilates and adapts to American culture much. Uncle Meyer, who is 20 years older than Nathan, remains very much an old world character, even though he lives in New York. He's a tailor on the Lower East Side. He is a semi-observant Jew, not too observant. He retains his accent. He speaks Yiddish. He has a love for Yiddish theater, which was very big when he was in America at the time. But Nathan moves to Long Island. He starts off working as a cutter in the garment district and is promoted to a supervisor of cutters, and he winds up with some responsibility. He's the first one who really owns his own car, buys a house, and he's the one that is pulled both in one direction by his connection to the old country and Uncle Meyer, and the other direction in his connection with his children, who are adapting rapidly to American culture all around them. So Nathan is an interesting man. He is a man who is basically a good man, but like a lot of first-generation characters, he has his prejudices. I think a lot of first-generation, especially minority Jews, Italians, and Irish, often say, we adapted to this country, and why can't the African-Americans and the Hispanics do what we did? It's a very kind of prejudicial thing, because it doesn't take into what they've had to go with, the linguistic and the racial problems. So there is in Nathan a little bit of racism, but it's not, virulent racism. He wants to be a good man. He just can't quite adapt to that. And as his kids grow up, he has trouble recognizing them. One of the five siblings, the third son, is gay.
Right.
And one of the dramas of the book is it takes him a long time to come out, and Nathan could never quite accept that.
I'm not going to give away which one it is. They have to read the book to find out.
Oh, it's pretty obvious from the...
It was obvious to me right away. I catch on real fast. Okay, so we have... My other favorite character was Bobby, because she had spunk, and I liked her. But what was the problem with Lillian, the mother, the stepmother?
Well,
why
she
didn't
had
they
the
like
problem...
Her?
Well, she had the problem of all stepmothers.
I was a stepmother a long time ago.
I'll give you just a canvas for the listeners. So there are five children. The first son is named Jackie. He was born in 1940. And he will wind up being a politician and a lawyer. The second son is Michael, born in 1942, who is a businessman and an entrepreneur. And the third child is the daughter, Elaine, who is a school teacher and marries young. And these three children were born of Ida, who is dead when we begin this story. She died, I believe, in the 1940s, absolutely, when they were very young. Nathan then remarried Lillian, who was about 10 years younger than him, and two other children were born, Stephen in 1947 and Bobby in 1950, the baby of the family. So you have a step-parent situation. Lillian, like most stepmothers, walks into a difficult situation. She marries Nathan because she's getting older. I don't know if it was ever a love match, but she felt she admired him. He wasn't a man who spoke not only English but Yiddish, who was a good provider. And she winds up starting a business, running a beauty parlor. I don't think the kids disliked her so much as they gave her a hard time.
Because
she was the stepmother. I mean, the joke, family joke, was that she always overcooked the turkey on Thanksgiving.
Turkey, I know.
and that's, families always have these jokes where somebody does something and people talk about it. But I don't think Lillian was disliked so much as she was. She was a little bit of an assistant member of the family. She wasn't quite the main member of the family.
Yeah, it seems like she always had to that she always had to sort of find her place in the family.
Right. And Ida, yeah. who, you know, who we never meet, it was yeah. a bit of Nathan idolized her. She was the sainted Ida who was the perfect mother and cooked perfectly and cleaned perfectly. And it's always hard act for a woman to walk into a situation where the mother who's passed away is idealized by the family. But what might be useful, just so your listeners can mm-hmm. follow, I'll tell you a little bit about the five characters, and then we can talk about them so they have a little reference to yep. them. Jackie, who's the oldest, is a outgoing, energetic man who doesn't like to work that hard. He's a womanizer. He is what I call a functioning alcoholic. He has a drinking mm-hmm. problem, but he lives with it. And he winds up getting himself through law school. It wasn't easy because he also has a gambling problem. And when he starts working as a lawyer, he winds up inadvertently, perhaps, doing some business for the Nassau County mob. He mm-hmm. does little stuff like papering real estate deals, and he develops contacts with the mob that will come back eventually to haunt him. Because eventually he gets into politics. He becomes the district attorney of Nassau County, and he deals with problems of that. He marries late in life, has a challenging child who is autistic, but he's full of life, Jackie, and he's one of these guys that has always got his arm around you, but has his demons. Michael, the second son, who's a couple of years younger than Jackie, is kind of interesting. He's quiet. He marries young, a woman named Naomi, who's a Jewish girl from Shaker Heights, Ohio. And Michael is not so much a man who's interested in money. He's a gambler. He loves the challenge of business and starting businesses and making them work. And what he does is he starts businesses, he succeeds, and then he leaves too much money on the table, and he winds up having to start all over again. But he loves the challenge of it, he plays the American business dream. You know, he gets into the real estate boom when it's big, and then that goes bust on him. He gets into cable television. He gets into the internet bubble, and that goes bust. So things keep blowing up in his face.
Yeah.
The third child, Elaine, is probably the one closest to. I have a sister who's a little bit like her. She was the nice Jewish girl who married the doctor and made her parents very happy. And she married a man they met while he was still in medical school. And she worked as a school teacher in Manhattan. And though it's not a bad marriage, it was a marriage that she never really thought that much about. And about 15 years into the marriage, she really questions whether or not she wants to live the life she's living, which is essentially a woman bringing up children in a home on Long Island. And she goes through the feminist revolution in her own mind that was very prevalent, I think, starting in the mid-70s, where women began saying, is this all there is to it? Are we just, you know, wives and mothers? And she winds up having some interesting adventures. Her marriage ends, she meets somebody else, and there you go. Those are the three children with Ida. The fourth child, Stephen, who was the first child born with Lillian, is a bookish, smart, shy young man who's a good student but doesn't quite fit in. And it becomes fairly obvious, certainly to the reader, if not to Stephen himself, that he's gay. But this was in an era in the 60s and 70s where, you know, there was no gay and lesbian club in high school. So if you were gay during that era, it was very difficult. You couldn't come out to your friends, to your family. You had to live with that and figure out who you are and fight it. And he fights it for some time. He eventually becomes a writer and has some success at that. He goes into the Army. He's drafted, goes to Vietnam, becomes a medic. And his life odyssey is really fascinating. He eventually does come out, but not until the 1990s when his father is dying, and he has to face that confrontation with him. And finally, the baby of the family, whom you said is your favorite character, Bobby, Roberta. She's the problem child. She was the one who gets into sex, drugs, and rock and roll in high school. This was, I guess, in the mid-60s, in the mid to late 60s, when that was fashionable. And she's always getting into trouble. She's, you know, gets caught smoking marijuana and on a peace march, and they have to bail her out. She goes to Woodstock and winds up having sex with some guy on an acid trip, and who disappears in the morning, and she winds up, of course, pregnant. And she has an illegitimate daughter whom she names Grace Slick, after the lead singer of the Jefferson Airline.
Airplane.
Jefferson Airplane, yeah. And anyway, she grows up. She brings up this. She's a single mom. She goes to the West Coast. She lives in San Francisco for a while and then gets into the music business in Los Angeles and becomes a very successful music producer. So those are the five siblings, and even as they, as I said, they go out on their own life paths, they come together as a family always or most of the time for Thanksgiving and for Passover. Those two times a year, they come back to New York if they're able to, and they reunite as a family. So those are the main characters.
I think we've got it. Well, you know, it sounds like most families, we get together on Thanksgiving and Passover, but you find that there's one, and it's great that Lillian still does it, because I find that since I lost my sister and my mother last year, that I find that sometimes the family sort of dissipates and just disappears. And there's always one person that does everything, and then when someone else wants to start to do the same thing, they don't always accept it. So when you wrote this, I have a question from the chat room from Karen.
Okay.
And Karen wants to know, what is the difference between writing a script and what did she say? Do you find it different writing a book as opposed to a script, she wants to know.
Oh, definitely. Much different. I've done a lot of script writing. I really started most of my work in the television and film business in Los Angeles. And it wasn't until the late 1980s and 1990, early 1990s, that I started to write books, which was always my first love. Both types of writing require good story sense and good characterization. I think that's really the sense of a good writer, is telling a story that you care about, that the reader gets involved with. The difference is that a screenwriter is just part of a movie. Once the script is over, he or she becomes just, first of all, becomes dispensable. He or she is usually no longer around when the filming is. And often they bring in other writers to rewrite what you've done. The directors and actors feel perfectly free to change dialogue, to, you know, add to their vision of it. And I think most writers who live and work in Hollywood have to learn to live with that. The quid pro quo is it's very well paying. You know, as a day job, you do very well. Writing a book is more about the sound of the author's voice. It's language. It's the ability to go inside a character's head and describe what he or she is feeling and thinking. It's much more of a, I think, in my mind, of a right brain activity. Even though there's a spine of story, we're all drawn to good novelists because of the way they tell stories. You know, it's like someone telling a joke. You can give five people the same joke, and, you know, one person will kill with it, and, you know, one person will die with it, and the other two people will be, three people will be somewhere in between. The book, from a financial point of view, writing books is particularly precarious because we're living in an economy that is considered to be post-literate. So many people are spending time on the internet and watching television, going to movies. But I think that hopefully there'll always be a need for the author's voice in novels.
I truly hope so. Which brings me to my next question. You seem very good here. Thank you, Karen, for that question, because it lends right into creating the storylines for each character in this particular book. And I know that when they write screenwriters, because Tess Gerrinson said the same thing with Rizzoli and Isle. She said they change everything in the script from what she wrote in her books, and she feels like she doesn't even know the character sometimes. Even the appearance of the character, the way you might picture Uncle Meyer or Nathan, the person that cast him might not picture the person the same way. So
right, absolutely.
Yeah, right? And
when
that's
you surrender the right, when you sell your, as a novelist, if you sell the right to make a film or a television series of your book, you surrender the right to do anything. I mean, you just get the money.
Really?
It's very simple. No, I don't think any film company or studio will buy a book from an author with the limitation that you can't change anything. It just doesn't go with this. So you just kind of live with that. My first book, The Deal, was made into a movie in 2008. William H. Macy played the main character in Meg Ryan.
I love him.
And it's a satire about the movie business. It's called The Deal. It's available on Amazon. In fact, all my books are available on Amazon Kindle, very reasonably. Most of them are like $3.99. And I have nine books out there. But with that particular arrangement with Bill Macy, he was a friend of mine. He came to me, he said, I really want to do this. I said, fine. They filmed it in South Africa, and I thought they did a pretty credible job. But I would have had no business saying, you know, I didn't like what you did with this character, this scene, because that's not what it's about. I think most novelists look at the movie business as a kind of way of financing their career as novelists, you know, because you make more money selling rights to film rights than you do writing books, unless, of course, you're Daniel Steele or Robert Ludlum or Stephen King. I mean, I've made more money. My second book is called The Dreyfus Affair, and it's a comic novel about two baseball players who fall in love and the kind of scandal it causes, the public relations embarrassment to Major League Baseball, because baseball is the most conservative institution we have in our country. That book has been optioned 6 times for movies, and some of them were very nice sums of money. It still hasn't been made, but I made maybe 10 times the amount of money optioning it than I got paid by Random House for getting the book published. So, I mean, I'm not happy with that. I'd much rather have a movie of it because I think it would make a terrific movie, but at the moment it's still available.
I know a lot of people are under the impression that just because they get an option for something that it's going to be made into a movie, and that doesn't always mean the case. But you know what? Sometimes when you have a specific character in mind and you picture the character in a specific way and then they give you somebody that is totally different, it sort of like detracts from, oh, I know I read the book, and that just doesn't go with the book. So when you created the storylines for each character, how did you manage to blend them together to make the plot so cohesive and keep each primary character within each chapter of the story? We learn about every single one of them. That's hard to do.
Well, it's 30 years of training, of practice. No, I mean, that's part of the craft of writing. I don't know if you can explain how it's done. I mean, if you would ask a painter how he manages to get his colors to harmonize, you'd probably get an answer. I don't know. I think I've said this before, that writing for television and screen has actually been a good apprenticeship as a novelist, because it's provided me with a kind of discipline of telling stories in an economic way. Because, you know, you have to learn as a writer not to be self-indulgent. Most young writers think that everything that comes out of their mouth is brilliant or on their computer. And you have to learn to be a little bit more discriminatory in cutting your own work when it goes off track. And I have a kind of built-in gyroscope that came from writing all that television where you have to tell a story in 43 minutes with 4 commercial breaks. You learn how to do that. So I think that made me a more disciplined novelist. But still, like most novelists, a lot of this stuff is just coming out of my subconscious. In this particular book, the only outline I really had was I knew the beginning and the ending date. And I knew something about what was going to happen on 9/11. But I wasn't sure about which character it was going to involve. And I knew who the 5 characters were. That's pretty much all. And then I also had as a roadmap the social history of the country. I mean, the kind of motif of this book, besides being a story of an American family, it is hopefully also the story of America during the last half of the 20th century. All the stuff that we went through, those people who were born in the 40s and 50s, the baby boomers going through the Vietnam War, the rise of feminism, sexual liberation, drugs, politics, all the changes that we went through, the computer, are things that affect these characters in this family in a very dramatic way. So on one level, An American Family is also a story of hopefully of all American families, and also somewhat of a cultural history of the last half of the 20th century.
That's what made it really interesting. Mm-hmm. Is that for anybody that doesn't, even for people, I would think for kids that never learned about it or didn't grow up during that time period, this might be a very interesting way to learn about American history and those particular time periods. Because
well,
I don't find
I hope
that,
so.
That they learn that,
really
that they
hope
learn
so.
That anymore.
Yep.
Seems to be sort of like has waned, and you know, kids. I hear them on the street walking. Oh, why do I have to? I said because you really need to learn about your country and other places, mm-hmm. and you need to, you know, broaden your horizons other than, you know, whatever is on television that isn't probably worth watching. Mm-hmm. So you started with Kennedy and the assassination and September 11th, which was just 2 days ago. That's really amazing that this happened. That the show was like 2 days after, mm-hmm. and I know that everyone lost someone that day.
Yes.
So. Yeah, I know. One of my students died in the first tower, and I dedicated my fourth book to her memory, to Janine, because of it. So tell me something. On that vein, why didn't the Pearls trust politicians then? They didn't like them.
Who does like politicians?
I had to ask that question. Sorry, I had to ask that question.
Who
does? Nobody
well,
does.
It's interesting that one of their, you know, that their oldest son, Jackie, becomes a politician. But
yeah.
Just to go back briefly on the question of what's happening in America and how it affects us, the Vietnam War caused an incredible rupture in this country that has not yet been repaired. Yeah. I feel that it was the first war in the history of this country which was not entirely supported by everyone. And it created a cultural divide and rift that we're seeing played out today in you know, the Tea Party and Democrats and this deep chasm of cultural divide that this country is facing. And one of the things I deal with in the book is how the Vietnam War in the mid-60s and late-60s affected the Pearl family and how they had different attitudes toward the war. And, you know, the father, of course, thinks we have to go there because our country is involved in war. And, you know, it's a worldwide communist threat to take over the world, and the younger kids question that. And that causes rifts in the family. So I think many people can relate to those discussions and that we were having during the Vietnam era.
Mm.
And the same thing about, you know, feminism and marijuana and all those other phenomena of the time.
I know, there's a whole lot of... controversy over marijuana and whether it should be legalized or whatever. Mm-hmm. I actually interviewed an author that was in Phnom Penh, and he was arrested because he sold marijuana and a whole bunch of other stuff. And he wrote, actually, his book Herb Traders was quite interesting because he did it in order to make a living for his family, and if he had to do it again, I don't think he would, but it's a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. Karen wants to know, are books with a lot of dialogue more conducive to script conversion?
Good question. Probably in that you already have a lot of the dialogue written for you, so you don't have to invent dialogue from whole cloth.
Yeah.
You know, I think there isn't a simple way of figuring out what books are good for film. One of the things probably would be if there's a lot of interior monologue, and a lot of things going on inside the heads of the characters, that's very challenging to do as a screenplay, because how do you get those thoughts out?
Yeah.
You could have voiceover narration, but that gets to be a little bit, if you do too much of that, that gets a little bit, you know, non-visual. And I think, you know, a good story is still a good story, and but you also have to think of the fact of a visual aspect for a film. What is it? If you have two people sitting in a room talking, that's not going to be a very interesting film. But if you have something that is visual, that has some action to it, that has some ability to use photography and use cinematography and use editing to not only to tell a story but enhance a story, then I think it's very, very challenging. Yeah.
Well, next question. Okay.
Sure.
Nathan is part of his family. This may seem like a weird question, but yet sometimes I felt like he was disconnected. mm-hmm. to what was really happening in the family, just because I just really read the book.
Right.
Each of his children changes in some type of way, but he doesn't really see it. Why doesn't he realize what's happening, and why doesn't Lillian see the changes in them? Well, she wouldn't maybe as much as he did. He sort of like alienates himself and sort of stands back or just thinks everything's perfect. So how come he doesn't see what's really happening?
Well, first of all, some of it is generational, but mostly I think parents are a little bit blind to who their children are. Our children grow up in a different world than we know. And in Nathan's case, the life change was so dramatic. Nathan was born, I think he was born in 19, he came to the country in 1911 or something. And he came to the country in 1928 at 7. He came and worked in a sweatshop on the Lower East Side. But his life experience was limited compared to what his kids were like. I mean, his kids grew up with television. They grew up with cars. They grew up with all these things that were not in Nathan's life. They grew up with liberated women. And so I think it's hard for Nathan because he's the one that has, you know, half his foot is still back in the old country in this little village in eastern Poland, and the other half is back in the new country. I mean, my father was very much like that. My father, as I said, grew up in Poland, but he didn't work in the garment district. My father was a lawyer, an exceptional man who put himself through school, learned English, and 8 years from the time he got off a boat, he was a lawyer, which is really quite amazing. But then I grew up in New York City playing stickball on the streets, and my son was born in Paris. So, you know, just think of the generational change of our particular family.
That's my grandfather was a tailor. Like I said, he sold apples on a street corner on Sunland Boulevard in Tremont.
Mm.
Then he opened up a laundromat, and then he opened up a huge dry cleaning store on 181st Street and Mohegan Avenue, and then he bought 5 more stores, one for each son-in-law or son.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, we grew up in a dry cleaning family, and I'm sure the same applied in your family. It was a strong work ethic. And it was like from the time I was 12, I was working in the cleaning store on Saturdays because my mother had this thing. You did homework, you went to school, you studied, and the summer vacation was either your work or went to school.
Mm-hmm.
There was no such thing as having free time. No, not my heart. So, I mean, I can tell you how to press clothes. I can tell you how to get stains out. And I can tell you how to bag them in the back. But we came from a dry cleaning family, but I was the first person to graduate college. I graduated when I was 18. So, yeah, my dad was kind of proud because he said, oh, gee, my daughter went to college. My sister, she ran a doctor's office, and she was very, very smart, but she chose a different route. But, yeah, that's just different. So when Meyer, I love Uncle Meyer, sorry, meets Yvette, what's the problem with that? This older guy decides to marry somebody. That's pretty cool.
Okay. Meyer, who is a man in his late 70s, early 80s, he's a bachelor. He, at one point in his life, was a bit of a boulevardier, if there's such a thing, in that he loved the Yiddish theater and he would date actresses, but he never got married. And he's sitting in the park one day at age 78, and this woman approaches him and starts speaking to him because she recognizes him as a guy who has a nice overcoat on. And her name is Yvette Nussbaum, and she's a real character. We don't know whether she's a gold, you know, she's out for, and she eventually weaves her way into the family, and she becomes a Meyer's girlfriend, I guess. And, you know, we don't know whether he actually marries her or not. And Meyer keeps changing his will. So it's kind of a comic subplot. And she's a character. She's funny. She's opinionated. And, of course, the kids mostly find her a bit impossible. But, what happens is that the family changes also. It grows. It changes. It becomes different sizes and shapes, and so she winds up going now to Thanksgiving dinner and Passover. We have Yetta, her name is Yvette, the old Yiddish theater actress. And then as the children marry their spouses and their children start coming to Thanksgiving dinner, and you suddenly have what you may remember, the kids' table, when the younger kids were set to a separate table because, you know, there wasn't enough room around the original table. And this, again, the evolution of the family. I mean, look at the very popular show on television now called Modern Family. This is an example of a non-traditional family, which is becoming more and more current in American life, and in fact, more and more current universally.
I'm beginning to understand that. You know, it's funny when kids get to be a certain age. I'm used to my nieces when they were younger calling me every day. Can you help me with your homework on my phone? Mm-hmm. Or what's up? Or what are you buying in the store? Or what should I wear to a party? Even though they live 10,000 miles away, now that they're 16 years old, they don't need my help, but they do because my fashion sense is so much better. That you know,
right.
You begin to wonder. Yeah, yeah. My nephews who are, you know, 17, 15, and going to be 13, they call me and say, well, you know, we need your help with this. We still need your advice. Mm-hmm. So it makes you feel good once in a while they do remember you. So what caused the many rifts in this family, and how come you decided to choose? You see, autism is near and dear to me as an educator, and my nephew was autistic. So what made you decide to choose a special needs child for Jackie, which I really thought was great?
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought that was an irony because Jackie, he marries late. He marries a woman from his office whom he's always had kind of a little bit of a friendship with, and he realizes that he needs to get married because he wants to go into politics, and they get married. It turns out to be a pretty good marriage, actually. She's an okay person, and the luck of the draw, they have a learning disabled child, and they spend a fair amount of time in denial about it, which is not uncommon, I think. I've been told with parents of these types of children, is you don't want to admit that the problem is there for a while because it is so horrendous to realize that you will now have a burden pretty much for the rest of your life. But this child, like many apparently disabled children, is very endearing. And I've been told about people who have mongoloid or autistic children that though they're difficult, they're also very endearing, they're very affectionate. And Benji, the name of the child, becomes kind of adopted by the entire family. Even though it's Jackie's child, I think the whole family kind of adopted. He comes to all the dinners, and he gets very attached to the family also. Because the family keeps pulling these people back from wherever they are. You know, they come back for these holidays. They sit around the table. They gossip. They talk about one another. They care about one another. And I think that, you know, why I made that choice, I guess, wanted to complicate the situation a little bit because, you know, conflict is important in any type of writing.
That is true. I think a book without conflict would really be kind of, depending on the book, would be boring. So Karen has another question.
Okay.
You wrote about this family. Would you write about a family that's totally out there and dysfunctional?
Well, of course. Well, first of all, tell Karen that she should check out my book called 11 Karens. All you have to do is Google me, Peter Lefcourt, Lefcourt, and you'll get my website. And if you click on my website, which is just, you know, peterlefcourt.com, you'll have a list of all my books and how you can get them. But 11 Karens is a story of a highly fictionalized version of a man's love affair with 11 women named Karen.
Well, she's going to love you for that.
Well, we've never, Karen and I have never met, but I'm just saying
and she's a trip, Karen. You have to know what she writes. She's a riot, so she'll love it.
Yeah, but it was just a conceit I had. I realized at one point in my life that I had, for some reason, I had more relationships with women named Karen than with any other name. I think there was actually only 3.5. So I decided to expand it, and the book tells the story of a man who starts, you know, in the fifth grade, getting involved in a mock marriage with a girl named Karen in somebody's garage, and it goes all the way up to his adulthood. But anyway, now I've forgotten the question, so let me have it.
She said to tell you that was a good name for the story.
Oh, great. Absolutely. But, you know, writers, they're like addicts. You know, you store all this stuff up in your head, and it comes out in different phases, you know, different shapes and forms. I always tell people, you know, they're never safe around me because I'm always working. Mm-hmm. We go to a party, we go to a restaurant, and we look around, and things occur to us that are interesting, funny, sad, dramatic. And often we store them up for a while, and then we use them in different contexts. Sometimes they come out in funny sorts of ways. This book, An American Family, is different to some extent than my other books. Most of my books are what I would call satirical fiction. They are comedies, but they're with, you know, a little bit of sentiment and romance in them. But they tend to be comic fiction, satire. As I said, The Deal is a satire on the movie business. The Dreyfus Affair is a satire on baseball. My third book is called Die and I, and it is a highly fictionalized recounting of my love affair with the late Princess Diana. I had gone to England in 1994 while she was still alive to do research on a television movie called The Women of Windsor. It was about the third or fourth royal family movie that CBS was financing because it got good ratings. And while I was there, though I didn't meet her, I met a lot of the paparazzi, and it occurred to me what would have happened if Diane and I had really met and we had run away together and had a love affair.
Well, that sounds cool.
And decided to move to Cucamonga, California, and start a McDonald's, which is what happens in Die and I.
That's hysterical.
Yeah, anyway, those are the types of whimsical books that I like to write. So An American Family is a more serious, a little bit more heartfelt than my other books. But there's humor in it also, as you yourself pointed out. I want to take a moment, though, to talk a little bit about publishing and the choice of publishing American Family digitally. Your listeners will find out very soon that you can't get a print copy of An American Family. And this was a decision that I made after some amount of soul-searching. My first three books were published by Random House, and my next four were published by Simon & Schuster. And though I have nothing personally against these publishers, they're enormous corporations. They're run by multinational companies. They publish 500 books a year. And I felt that, you know, why am I giving them 88% of the profits of every book I sell? Because you get a 12% royalty in exchange for a nicely printed copy of this book and what I consider to be fairly pro forma publicity and copy editing. So when this book came out, I made a decision that I wanted more people to read this book, and I didn't need to make that much money. I was more interested in people reading than, you know, becoming rich as a writer. And so Amazon came to me. They approached me through my agent and said, you've got, you know, these seven other books, and no one's reading them because they're not in bookstores anymore. And they were published, many of them were published, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And we will give you electronic access to all your books, plus this new book, and we will give you a 70% royalty.
Wow.
And we will promote it on our website. So I thought about this for some time because a lot of my friends feel that Amazon is kind of the mafia of the book business. You know, they are driving bookstores out of business, and they're converting more and more people to electronic reading. And I went back and forth on what was the right thing to do, and I finally realized something that I think trumps all other reasons, and that's the simple fact that more people are reading more books now because of electronic publishing than they did before. So whatever you think about the death of bookstores, or electronic publishing is not only a good thing, it is not just the future. I think it's the present, and I think the fact that anybody can just click on download a book and read it, to me, is a wonderful thing. You can travel with, you know, a whole bunch of books. The first reason I got a Kindle about 5 years ago, even before I decided to publish electronically, because I was going on a long trip, and I loved the idea of taking a whole collection of books with me. And I thought that was important. And finally, there's the ecological reason. And my son gives me a hard time about it. It's his universe. He says, Dad, it's our world that you're chewing up. I realized something, that in conventional publishing is a very dysfunctional business model. What they do is they buy a book, and then somebody in their marketing department decides that X number of copies should be printed. And this generally is determined by the number of books you sold with your last book. So it's a very kind of, you know, it's kind of a brain dead calculation. and they print the books up. They put them on trucks. They ship them across the nation. They stick them in bookstores for maybe 10 days to 2 to 3 weeks, if you're lucky. And then the ones that they don't sell,
they send them back.
They put them back in the trucks. They bring them back. And you know what they do? They pulp them. And I started thinking about this horrible thought of my books being pulped. I almost had a physiological reaction of all these words. And I said, you know, this is stupid. You know, why are we doing this? Why are we burning all this gasoline and using all this paper when we can read so much? Anyway, so I went to that decision, and I'm so glad I did, because not only I don't know whether the finances are working out in terms of what this book would have sold if I went back to a big publisher. That doesn't concern me, but I know that I'm selling a lot of books. I'm getting a lot of emails on my website. And I know more people are reading it, and that's what makes me happy. So that's why I went that way with this particular book, and will go this way with... I just put a new book out called Le Jet Lag. It's a comedy about five Americans at the Cannes Film Festival that I actually written 5 years ago, and it got tied up with a small publisher who bought the book, and then McCannum Cage, and then they went belly up and got stuck in litigation. I finally got the rights back to it, and I just put it up on Amazon. And it's a very funny book about five Americans at the Cannes Film Festival.
Yeah, but I have a question about
that
also, because, well, first you have to send me a paper copy, because I told you my eyes just don't do it. Second of all, Amazon will promote you, but let's say... a self-published author like myself, because I have 9 titles. Two of them were published by a traditional publisher, but yet I have promoted myself. My first 4 books, 6 books, are about Alzheimer's, and 3 nonfiction, 3 children's. Now, they're all in electronic. How do you get people? Now, Amazon is not going to notice my titles. They're going to notice yours because of who you are. And they're going to approach you to promote your book and get it on there electronically because of who you are. They'll do the same thing they did to Steve Berry, they did to a whole bunch of other people. Mm-hmm. But if you're not Peter Lefkowitz or Steve Berry or Tess or somebody like that, how do you get them to do the same thing for you? In other words, to promote it and say, okay, this person's going to get, you know, this person's book is really great. How do you get them to notice you?
Well, you hire a publicist. That is
I've
really
got
the
two
only-
of those.
That's the only way to do it. There are people now, though, who are specializing in internet publicity, which is a different ball game. Publicists used to set up book readings for you. You'd go, you'd read your book, you'd sign books. You can't obviously do that with an electronic book. So the secret now is getting your book reviewed by blogs. There are literally thousands and thousands of blogs, and many of them are book reviewing blogs, people who read books and recommend them to friends, and you
That's
need to
I
get
do.
Into those.
That's what I do.
Well, there you go. You're
That's
you're
what I do.
You're one of the people that are helping internet publishing. But look, the math is not good on. There are literally somebody told me there's something like 15,000 books that go up on Amazon every week.
Yeah.
I mean, there's millions of books out there. So, yes, you need to find a way. No one is going to stumble on your book unless they're told to go there. So some of it is hiring publicity. The other is doing your own publicity. For example, you have to go on Facebook, and you got to go on Twitter, and you've got to tweet friend, and you have to toot your own horn. Otherwise, and you have to be on programs like this so people know who you are. Otherwise,
well,
no one is going to know that.
Because I do the show.
Well, that helps.
Yeah.
You have a chance to promote
your
book.
I tweet. As a matter of fact, for those people that don't know, Twitter, Facebook friend feed is fantastic because it's like Twitter.
Mm-hmm.
I did Scoop It, but that doesn't quite do the same thing. And Blurty is really good. And I put all of your reviews and everybody on StumbleUpon. And yeah, people do read them. And my Gabina blog on WordPress, they've read your review. Everybody reads my reviews of other people's books, which is great. So at least I feel like I'm helping everybody, which is good. But electronic, I mean, putting this show on iTunes and on demand and stuff like that. And Marcia Cook is the person that runs the World of Ink with Virginia. And she's going to put this on all the social networks and everything so that everybody knows, because she belongs to a whole other bunch of stuff that I might not belong to, plus the fact that I belong to tons of things. Plus, I was lucky, by the way, that your publicist, Kay Trainer, she's the best. She makes phone calls. She hounds you until you get it done. Let me tell you, she hounds me too. I was lucky because she asked me if I wanted to read the book. And I was lucky that she sent it to me. So I get lucky once in a while, and I get really some really fantastic books like yours, because I don't always get such good books to read. Which brings me to my next question before we go back to the book. How much value do you place in book reviews? And why is it necessary? I mean, I just wrote an article that's out there on book reviews, and you don't ask your family to review your book.
Mm-hmm.
You ask somebody that's impartial, that doesn't know you, but you also, I think, have to check out the person in the style to make sure that they actually read the book. Like you said, you know, I read it. So how much stock do you place in a book review? How does that help your sales or not? And what happens?
Well, again, it's online book reviewing, and I think as a reader, I have reviewers whom I check online. But the other thing that you can do on Amazon is you can download at no cost a sample of the book. They'll let you download 30 pages of a book just to see if it's a style and a voice that appeals to you. But book, listen, reviewers have always been important. I think people who read books are not quite as, I'm trying to find a delicate way of saying this, as flighty as people who see, people who go to see movies may go to see a movie because of a movie star. They'll say, oh, this is a movie with this person, I want to go see that. But most people who read books pretty much know what they like. They know the type of story that appeals to them. So they look into a book review, and not sometimes it's not necessarily whether the reviewer likes the book or not, but what the reviewer says will say to me, you know, this is material that's going to appeal to me. I like the subject of this book. I like the humor. I like the politics, whatever that might be. But, you know, we're living in an era for authors where you must promote your work. It's something that a lot of writers find distasteful. I think this is a generalization, but like all generalizations, there's a lot of truth in it. Most writers are fairly retiring people in terms of tuning their own horn. They don't like to do it, which is one of the reasons we become writers. Otherwise, we'd become, you know, actors.
Yeah.
We'd go out there and toot a lot. So it becomes a difficult thing. When I wrote published my first book, it was 1990. Okay, so 22 years ago, it was in ancient history. But Random House had a whole organization that did all this stuff for me. I mean, yes, I did some publicity, I traveled, I did interviews, but I didn't have to do a whole lot myself. It was all set up for me, and I basically showed up and read the book and would talk to people about it. But it kept changing, and by the time my seventh book, which is called The Manhattan Beach Project, which published in 2005 with Simon Schuster, I pretty much had to drive that campaign myself, and everything was done. I didn't travel anymore. They stopped sending me out on books, tours. I had to come up with my own questions. I had to, you know, I had to push things to make it happen. So I think if you're going to be interested in writing, you need also be interested in public relations. You know, I don't know how the authors feel about that, but I'm not delighted with it just because I find it takes time away from writing.
No, I agree with you. I was just lucky because I work for Hillcrest Media, and rather than take money, because I don't get money for doing reviews, I don't get money for doing anything, they said that if I would do reviews for them, they would promote my last two books. So I felt that was a better deal, you know, to have a publicist than didn't get money for to do anything, because I do things for free, and getting paid would ruin my fun of doing it for free.
Right. Yeah, so we
everything
all have to
I
pay
do
the rent.
Free. I know.
You know.
I even when I work for my father, my sister managed to get more money than I did. I don't know how she did it, but you know, money never really was the most important thing to me. But obviously, it should have been. So you've done screenwriting, you've done producing, and you've done everything. So if you could do something else. Anything else? Would you do anything else but what you're doing now? Is there anything you never did before that you'd like to do?
I'd love to be a jazz musician or, you know, a scratch golfer, but I think it's too late for that. I'm a terrible golfer. You know, as somebody said the other day, I saw a bumper sticker, he said, golf is God's way of telling you have too much time on your hands. but no, seriously, I mean, I've never been able to really make a dime doing anything. I taught school a little bit in my 20s, and then I did something in my 20s. I was living in New York. And I was a cab driver, and I think, in all honesty, it was a terrific apprenticeship to becoming a writer because I spent the whole day listening to people talk. And the subject matter of all authors, certainly fiction authors, is life. It's conversation. It's language. It's what people discuss. It's the masks we put on and the stuff we tell each other in the subtext. And if you spend time listening to this, and, you know, in New York at the time, nobody, cab drivers were part of the machinery, people would have the most intimate conversations. and you would listen to them, and it'd be fascinating. And I think it was more valuable for me to spend 2 years part-time driving a cab than getting a PhD in creative writing at the Iowa School of Writing. That's just my feeling about it. I do feel strongly about that. I don't think you can teach someone beyond a certain amount of how to use the language. The rest of it is observation and sensitivity to the drama and humor of life.
Well, there's a statement in the chat room that you should like. The people in the chat room, Marcia said that you should definitely do radio on Blog Talk and interview us. He said you'd be great. You'd be great on Blog Talk Radio as an interviewer because you know the right questions to ask. So,
she said she would
love to have you on her show. She said the pay's not good here, but it's fun to do this. We don't get paid to do this either, but you know what? I've been doing this for 2 years and it's so much fun. I love it. Mm-hmm. This is great, and I've always been a shy, quiet little kid.
No, this is wonderful. Anything that promotes conversation, people talking about things and ideas. I mean, we live in a society that so many of us are parked alone in front of our computers or television set or whatever. I mean, we need to interact with one another because that's how you stimulate your life. You know, you need to talk to people because people are fascinating, and that's what gives you ideas, and that's what gives you inspiration, and that's what makes you, want to live, actually. And anything,
and
you guys do a great job.
Maybe you should write that book about the cab driving.
Right.
As a cab driver, but
right.
you have to send me the next one. Unfortunately, I actually really can't read on my computer because my eyes start to glare over, and the eye doctor said books only. So
I will certainly do that, and I said you can find a great deal more about me than you want to know on my website.
I couldn't find, I found the Di and I, and I found the deal, and I found all of that, but it didn't update that what you were working on television now or anything like that.
Well, that's my fault. I should. What I'm doing now, just so you know, on television, I'm trying to develop An American Family as a cable-limited television series. I feel like it's something that people would be interested in, the history of this family. I think we're all fascinated with family sagas from, Downton Abbey, for example, is an enormous hit on PBS. It's the history of this British family over time, which is what an American Family is. So I'm trying to do that. I'm starting a new novel.
What are you writing?
Well, I'm writing a novel. I don't like to talk too much about it because I'm not sure it's there yet, but basically it's a love triangle between three people in their 70s at a assisted living facility in Palm Springs.
Oh, I love it.
Pretty funny, actually. No, because people don't think, people don't think that anybody over 60 has a love life or a sex life, and that's not true. You know, it's a very vital time of life.
I'm not even going to go there on that one. all I know is I can remember that my brother's a little bit younger than me. We won't say how much. And I remember my sister and I were, a little older, and my mother comes in and says that she was having, a midlife crisis baby, my sister called it. And I said, well, isn't it cool that they're in their late 30s, whatever, and they're still doing, having fun? And she just looked at me and said, that is so gross. I go, shush. I was hysterical because she was getting married at 17, my sister. So my brother is 2 years older than my niece.
Mm-hmm.
So I found it kind of comical. And, as Marcia says, age is just a number, with which I've forgotten what mine is because I never can remember. I realize if you, tell people how old you are, then it catches up to you. Then you feel that age, and I never can remember what I am. So it doesn't really matter.
Yeah,
but
people make judgments about you, though.
Yeah, they do. They make something. They get on the phone and you tell somebody your date of birth, and all of a sudden, if they think you're over 25, they start to talk to you as if you're deaf and don't understand.
Right. Well,
and
especially in Hollywood, if you're over 30 in Hollywood, you're in trouble, let alone over 60.
Well,
but,
then Tom Cruise is in trouble too, poor thing.
I'm not going to worry about Tom Cruise.
I don't think you have
he's
to worry
gonna
about
him. He's going to land on his feet. The other thing I just want to mention very briefly, other good development in writing are reading groups. There seems to be a lot of reading groups, and I've spoken to a bunch of them, and I think they're great. I'm in a reading group. When you read a good book, you want to talk to somebody else about it. And there are online reading groups apparently also, which I think, I really think that's marvelous. As I said, writing is hard work. It never gets any easier. People think, well, you've written 8 books, it must get easier. It isn't.
Exactly.
It's hard work and it requires discipline. And you know that because, Fran, you're a writer. And I would encourage all your listeners, if you want to write, you know, don't talk about it and do it. And
just
don't stop until,
yeah,
you
right.
get, until you get tired and then go back and look at it.
You're going to only publish digitally, right? So I think that's a really, 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 really good point because my last book I actually published only in paperback and then they're going to put it digitally. My book is about my sister and I growing up. It's hysterical, Bertha and Tilly Forever. And it's about our antics being, you know, ourselves in the South Bronx and some of the crazy things that we used to do together. But I guess maybe it is better in some senses. But what about schools? What happens if there's no textbooks and stuff like that? And a kid, I know my niece is trying to get my niece into a private school and she needs a laptop. What happens if a parent can't afford the laptop to go to school or they can't afford the Kindle? And what happens if textbooks are only digital? What happens then?
Kindles are down to $79. So they'll get cheaper. I mean, look, I don't think you have to be a rocket science to know that electronic publishing is it's the future.
I know.
Guarantee that for literary fiction, at least, they will be almost very little published, certainly not in hardcover. In fact, hardcover literary fiction is almost extinct because no one wants to spend $32 to read a novel or carry it around or have it pulped. So I think it's a reality. We might continue to publish coffee table books and photography books and art books as print books, but it is the way I think people are reading and will read, and the younger generation will read more and more about it. Yes, there's a gap. There are people who can't afford this. But I'm not sure, you know, there's anything to do about that. It's like any cultural change, you've got to live through the transformation. All I know is that I believe strongly that more people are reading more books, and I've been backed up by people who've said that, and I think that makes me feel good. Not just my books, but all books.
I agree with you.
I download books every day. It's just so easy. You know, I hit something, and it's a book that interests me. I download it. It's on my Kindle, $3.99. I can look at it. I can look at a sample of it. And so, you know, again, I think it's good for writers and it's good for readers.
I think my UPS guy would be really happy if I did that because he just brought me 4 books. And then the FedEx guy just delivered another book that somebody actually printed out, the second book that this man wrote. And I read the first book, and that was enough, and now he sent me the second one. How special.
Right.
So I get to read another one. I just want to stop for 1 second, and because everybody's dying to know what my 5 picks of the 5 best books I've read this month are. And they are, and I don't know if I'm going to say her last name right, but I'm going to hope I do. Karina Goetz, Bloodbound, Reverend David and Faith McDonald, Heavenly Gems and Earthly Gems was hysterical. Rebecca D. Myers, My Journey from Heaven and Back. Reuter, which is about an educator that really hates educating, but in real life he doesn't, by Kit Betts Masters. And I Have What by Rich Weiner, who talks about his bout with breast cancer. And my number one pick for the month, believe it or not, is a poetry book by Fran Orenstein, Reflections. So everybody, those are the ones that I picked for this month. And the alternates are Head On by Jerry Banks and Donovan's Island by Daniel Neff. And, of course, don't forget An American Family by Peter Lefcourt. Those are my picks. They wait for me to put that on Facebook so that everybody knows what I've read. And I've read about 100 books in the last 3 months, maybe, seriously. Mm-hmm. So it takes me a while to decide which ones I like the best.
Well, good for you.
Yeah, so I really appreciate this, but I really want your new one.
I will. Unfortunately, I don't have a print copy of it. I have to make the print copies made up, so if I do, you will get it. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk for an hour or so, Fran. I think it's a great program, and
thank you.
I look forward to doing it again.
Anytime, Peter, that you want to do it again and I read another book or you just have a specific thing that you want to talk about, I do research, so it's okay.
Okay. Be
Thanks
well now.
Thank you so much. Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
Okay, for those of us, I just want to tell you that my next show is next Wednesday at 3 o'clock when I will be interviewing Brian Friedman. And I've read 6 of his books, Immoral, Stalked, Stripped, Burying Place, and a whole lot more. The Jonathan Stride series is something that you definitely want to read, and we're going to talk about The Bone House. Then the week after on September 27th at 4 Eastern. You're not going to believe it. I'm going to interview Tess Gerrington at 4. And Marcia is telling me, let's not forget JD's show is at 9 o'clock, I hope it is, on Saturday morning. JD Holiday does her show, and it's really great for kids and authors that read parts of their books. And I think that's right. I hope that is. And Marcia does A Good Story is a Good Story. Okay, it's 10 a.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. and 9 a.m. Central Time. 10 a.m. Eastern and 9 a.m. Central Time. And Marcia, do you have another show next week that I can broadcast? And on October 2nd, Marcia and I are going to interview Gerard DeMarini, Rise to the Call. And yeah, we've got Iris Johansson again next month. So until next Wednesday, Sandra and I will be back, and Marcia will be there, and everyone will be there. We're going to interview Brian Friedman, so have a nice day, and thank you, everyone, and good night. Bye.